Okay, welcome back to Wrestling Observer Live. I'm Dave Meltzer, editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. We're here with Brian Alvarez of Figure Four Weekly, and our special guest today, Bad News Allen from Calgary, a longtime wrestler, 22 years in the business, just having retired about a year ago. And I want to ask you also, now, did you have one knee done or two knees done this past year? You had them both done?
I was having trouble with my right knee, and it kept going out on me. And when I went in to see the specialist, he decided to x-ray both of them and said that actually the left was worse than the right. He said, I'll do one first, and then you come back in 6 months later, and I'll do the other one. And I don't particularly like being in a hospital, so I said, well, is there any way possible you can do both at the same time? He said, sure. So that's what happened. They did both of them at the same time.
And how was the recovery from having two knees done?
Oh, very good. Done 5 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you like? Oh, sorry. Keep going.
I can walk now without pain, and I can even start to jog a little bit. You know.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
How do you like doing the color on the Stampede shows?
I enjoy it. You know, my partner and play-by-play guy, he really cracks me up. You know. I'm always ridden him about being a bot because he gets so excited sometimes, but I really enjoy doing it.
Yeah. Is there a favorite, for you personally, a favorite style of wrestling? Because you've done UWFI, you've done New Japan, you did WWF, Stampede. Did it even really matter to you?
Well, I thought that New Japan Pro Wrestling and Stampede at the time, when Dynamite and them were here, I thought they were sort of close, similar. And I enjoyed that style because it was really more or less sort of hardcore, but it didn't go like, you know, the nonsense that they're going now today, you know. But I enjoyed that more than anything else.
There was an incident just pops into my head many, many years ago. So something happened with were you with Archie the Stomper Gouldy or Jeff Gouldy?
Yes.
What was the story? They actually replayed it on Stampede Wrestling about a month or two ago.
Right, exactly.
And I saw the interview with Archie Gouldy, which was a phenomenal interview. What was the story behind all that?
Well, the thing was that I was probably the only wrestler in the history up here that ever got suspended, really got suspended by the commission. And they really disliked me, you know. So after my third suspension, I just got off suspension, and I came in to do TV, and they came up with the idea they wanted to do this with me, the Stomper. They wanted to have a program with him and I, and they had this kid up here who was supposed to be his son. So I told him, I said, look, I said, I'm just off suspension for the third time. I said, you know this commissioner hates me. This guy actually had to try, he actually tried to get his best to actually have me run out the country, and that's a true story. He actually tried, and they said,
What were they, like, what charges or whatever were they suspending you for? Was it brawling in the crowd, or?
Well, yeah, you know, it's, the first time Dynamite and I, we had, we saw it everywhere we went, and we did the hardcore thing, and, you know, like, I would slam him on the table, and then I went and got an axe, and went to hit him with the axe, and he moved to chop the table in half, and stuff like that, you know. Actually, we were the originators of really hardcore wrestling at the time, our style, and, you know, the commissioner, he just flipped out. He claimed that nobody else ever did. I mean, they had Abdullah up here and King Curtis. You know, I couldn't have been the worst than they were, but they claimed that I was the worst and I should be tired and southern and driven out the country, you know. But anyway, so that was the program they set up for me and Stomper to work, but it all blew up, of course. They all put the heat on me and said it was my fault. Yeah.
So it got out of hand, and then, like, they got moved out of Calgary for a while, right? Didn't they have to, like, run the shows outside the city limits?
Yeah, we actually had to run on the South Sea Reserve, which is a native reserve just outside of Calgary. The commissioner had no authority out there, so we actually would run there. And the people would come from the city. It's not that far outside the city, but they would actually come out there and just pack the place. We'd run the shows there because they actually Stu lost his license in the city, and they yeah, it was really, and like for 2 weeks in a row, every day in the Sun newspaper up here, they would run a story on the front page with a picture of me and just all kinds of stuff. It really hit the fan when they went down.
Did it make you a stronger heel as far as a draw, all that publicity?
Well, you know, it was funny because actually, it got so bad that the people you know, they always like to look for the underdog. They actually thought that I was in. They actually turned me a babyface.
Oh, really?
In fact, the wrestler, yeah. I came in, and the people would actually cheer me because they thought it was sort of unfair that, like I said, King Curtis and Abdullah and, you know, Stu had many wrestlers up here for years that have, you know, pretty much done stuff that we've done. And a lot of people really thought it was unfair that they just really attacked me the way they did. So actually when I came out, they actually had to turn me a babyface for a while because I was so popular. And then, of course, you know, the way we worked and everything, I wound up turning heel again, against Owen.
What were your thoughts as far as, like, the different, you know, because you worked against some of the real great workers of that period and people who gained, like, national fame, whether, like, Owen, Brett, Dynamite, Davey Boy Smith, Pillman, I guess. Did you ever work with Pillman, actually?
Actually, one time I worked with him up in Edmonton. He had a helmet match because, you know, he used to play football or something. I never played football, but we did a helmet match anyway.
What were your thoughts as far as, like, those guys, and some of them were in the infancy of their career when you bumped in Benoit? I mean, yeah. You were the one who, did you get the one who got Benoit in Japan?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm the one that I got him in.
Yeah. What was it? Did you just take a liking to him and just recommend him to the Japanese, or did he just want to go really bad and pave the way?
Well, you know, I'm like one of these guys. I'm a Libra, and we have, you know, the thing with the scale and everything. We hate to see injustice being done, you know. And I thought that here's a kid that had a lot of talent, a lot of potential, and I think that the office saw that too. And there was a lot of jealousy there, so they used to do all kinds of stuff to him, and would try to discourage him. And I really got sort of ticked off about it, so he actually moved down from Edmonton into Calgary, and he was living at his aunt's house a few blocks from where my home was. And I asked him one day, I said, would you ever think about going to Japan? He said, I would love to go. So I said, well, let me talk to a few people, and I went and talked to Nuki because I was like, this is his right-hand man. He used to, anything I wanted, he'd give it to me, you know, because he always liked me. I worked hard, and I never caused any problems. And I asked him, I said, would it be possible we can bring this guy over and put him in the dojo like me and let him train, you know? And he said, sure. And I never asked him for money or anything, and he said, we'll even pay him to, he said, you know, and so that's, we set it up that way, and that's the way it happened. They brought him over, and they kept him there, and they paid him and everything. He stayed in the dojo, and he ate. He had room and board free, and he ate free, and all he had to do was train to put his money in the bank.
Now, how would you compare as far as crowd enthusiasm, as far as fun for yourself? You were in New Japan during, I guess, that 82, 83, 84 period, where that, I guess, was the peak period for them. And then later, after that, you went to the WWF during a pretty hot period for WWF.
Right.
How would you compare those two atmospheres?
Well, you know, at both levels, well, the Japanese, you know, the Japanese audience at that time, when I first started over there, was a lot different. They were really quiet and everything. And I think once satellite TV came over, they became more boisterous, but they always drew good crowds, you know. Like, I mean, Inuki was like a god there. And wherever he showed up, places were always sold out. And it was the same thing when I went to WWF. Hogan was like a god. I knew Hogan before I came to WWF, because he used to come to Japan all the time. They always used him well there. And it was the same thing when I came to the WWF for the second time. Actually, was there once before. I worked for Vince's father.
Oh, that's right.
Just for
a little while, yeah.
Yeah, 78, I was there for a small period of time. But actually, when I came, like I said, when I got back and worked under Junior, Hogan was the same thing. He was like God to the people in the States, you know. So it was pretty similar. But I
this is... This is
you asked me a question. I never did answer it. You know,
about Dynamite and all those guys.
Yeah, only guys that I wrestled with, and I worked against everybody in the business just about. You know, I thought that, to me, two of the tremendous wrestlers that I ever worked against was Steamboat and Dynamite happened to be first, and Steamboat would have to be second. Those two I thought were two of the greatest wrestlers that I ever worked with.
Anything about him? Because like Dynamite was, you know, you worked a lot with Dynamite. He was actually much smaller than you.
Yeah, exactly. But he had, it was just, he was born for wrestling. I mean, he had everything going for him. What he did looked good. Like I always said, pound for pound, until somebody feels different to this day, I think the closest one is Benoit, probably. Pound for pound, I thought he was the best wrestler in the business ever. And even though he was small, he just had something about him, you know, that, like, the audience, he brought it out. The people, they just wanted to get in there and help him out, because he would sell in such a way that, you know, they just wanted to, he would ride with Frank out, you know. People just wanted to help him, you know, this big heel beat the hell out of him. It was just something about him, just the way he wrestled, man. Really, people really enjoyed it, you know. And I enjoyed working with him.
Do you think there's anything special as far as, like, why you clicked in Calgary so well? Was it just the right time? Because, you know, you were in other territories, and Calgary, you kind of became, like, the top heel for, you know, a couple of year period there.
Well, like I said, you know, Stu, like, he's the kind of guy, he don't care what color you are, who you are. If you can get out there and do the job, he's going to give you a chance. And that's the only thing I ever asked for is anybody. I never asked for no special favors or nothing. Just give me a chance to do my thing. And we'll go from there. And he just let me do that, and that's exactly what I did. And the people really brought it, which I thought in other territories, they always sort of just kept a lid on me. You know, they just wanted to have me there, but they really didn't have big plans on doing anything. You know, like they brought me in and they tell me all this nonsense, but you could always see the handwriting on the wall. They wasn't really planning on doing nothing.
Were there any territories you went to where you thought you were totally misused?
Well, I thought the WWF, I thought that they just let me cut loose and do my stuff, you know. Because they actually brought me in there on false pretenses, told me, you know, because actually when Stu sold his territory, he made arrangements for Dynamite, Davey, Brett, myself to go with Vince. But I didn't go because my wife was having a baby and I was my last one and I was always on the road with my other kids. So I figured I was going to be home. But once I came in there, I figured that they would just, you know, because they made a promise to me, well, you know, we never had an African-American world champ before, and this is great. You're a heel and everything, and we're really, you know, we want you to do it. We're going to, then Hogan, he's going to leave and make a movie. He's coming back a year later, and he can go all around the territory. And I think this is great, you know, but, you know, they just brought me in there because I guess he wanted to snatch up everybody, but he really didn't have plans to do much with me because any time that I got the main event or anything, I actually had to fight with him just to get in it, you know, like he did it, like, to throw me clumps. But he never really kept his word to me.
In Dynamite Kid's book, he kind of made the illusion that, you know, one of the reasons why he got to work with you so much was because a lot of the wrestlers in the Calgary territory were kind of scared to work with you. I mean, do you think that, I mean, everyone knew you were a tough guy from the judo and everything, and even out of the judo, you had a big rep in the business.
Uh-huh.
Do you think there was anything to that, or?
Well, you know, that's in their mind. They have to live with that, you know, because, like, I never came into the business to impress anybody, oh, yeah, well, I was a judo champ and Olympic champ and all this. You know, I came in there to do my job because I always told everybody when I got into the business, I have the scrapbook. I'm in this for the bank book. If I have to do a job every night, as long as you're paying me, that's all I'm concerned about. But I used to have trouble with people when they would lie to me and then they wouldn't pay me the money they supposed to pay me. And, of course, they didn't hear my mouth. But, you know, it's like a lot of these guys, too, that they never done anything outside the business. And what they would like to do is get young guys in there and just jerk them around, you know, pull all kinds of stunts on them. But, you know, I wasn't going to have that. I mean, I go in there and do my job, but if you get out of line, I'm going to straighten you out. It's that simple.
This is an email we got here from Frank Jewett, who says that these are questions regarding the, from your perspective as a worker, how different was the UWFI style from the traditional pro wrestling style that you had worked, and what did you like or not like about the style? And he also says, the UWFI had some high-profile instances of double-crossing and non-cooperation. He mentions Tamura, Matthew Saad Muhammad, Gary Albright, Tamura. I don't know if you're aware of those. I'm not even sure I know the whole story behind those two. But anyway, did you ever feel like someone was trying to double-cross you when you were in the UWFI?
Well, yeah, they did it actually at the end, you know, like they brought me in, same thing again, you know. What the thing was, if it was just a total shoot, then you would have to win on your own, lose on your own. And that would have been okay, you know. But the thing was is that it was a work and that certain guys wanted to go over and certain guys wanted to do this. You know, same old story with, you know, wrestling is today. And unfortunately, there was, like, I know the story with Gary and the other kid, and there was just a lot of double-crossing going on there. And they had too many chiefs in that office there and no Indians. That's what the problem was. Everybody wanted to be on top.
So what happened with Gary and the thing? Because I remember watching the tape where Gary just, like, took him down and held him down, and then
right.
It was a very strange-looking match.
Well, the problem was that they promised Gary was supposed to get another crack at the belt because they brought me over there to work with him, and I put him over. He was actually the champ. And then the belt was supposed to go to him, back to Takata, to Vader, and then they were going to set up a match with him and Vader and they was going to put him over. But then all of a sudden they started going a different direction. And they put him with the other kid who was a lot smaller than he was, and they wanted him to put him over. And Gary didn't want to do it because he felt that this was ruining his chances to get the belt back again. And I guess they got into a little shooting match there. So they got pissed off and they didn't want to pay Gary his money and anything. And I told him, I still pay him his money. You know, I don't care. You know, he still he came over here and he did what he was supposed to do, and that was it.
Yeah, and then he ended up with the. He ended up with All Japan, and UWF didn't last much longer. I remember a match. Go ahead.
Yeah, like I said, it was just too many things going on in there because I enjoyed going over there because I worked. We'd be in Japan for a week every month, and you'd only work one show, and that was it. And you got paid for the whole week. But the thing was that it was just too many guys in there, and everybody wanted to put each other over, and they were making a lot of money. They were selling out. Every time we went to all the big arenas, and we sold out. But it was just too much going on in the office there, and the Eagles were getting in the way, and that's what happened.
Okay. You know, when you started in wrestling in the mid-70s, did you expect you were going to last 22 years? Starting
not at all. Not at all. I had no idea, you know. I just got in there and just, you know, pretty much did what I was trained to do, and I was really surprised it lasted that long.
I read a comment, and I actually sort of had heard this story before, from Don Callis. Wrote a column about you and Andre the Giant back, I guess this would be in the early New Japan days.
Yeah, that's right.
What was the story about that?
Well, the story was they used to, Vince Sr. used to run the Madison Square Garden tournament, single tournament. He had the team tournament. So he'd bring in all the big stars over, Dusty and Hogan and Giant and everything. So one day we were going to a town, and I was sitting in the front of the bus, and I was sort of half sleeping. I think Hogan was sitting behind me, and Dusty was on the tour, and Chavo Guerrero and the Giant. Anyway, but he's in the back of the bus, and he started telling all these racist jokes. And I was like half sleeping. I woke up, and I heard all this nonsense going on. He's using throwing the N-word around left and right center. So then I finally said, look, man, I said, hey, I don't like what you say. You know, if you a bigot, that's your problem. But you just watch what you say around me, you know. So the bus got really quiet. You can actually hear a pin drop. And so as the bus continued to go on, all of a sudden he spoke up with that deep voice. He said, hey, Alan, you know. And I said, yeah, he told me to go ask myself, you know. So I told the bus, I said, pull the bus over. I said, if you want to talk to me like that, let's get off this bus. And I said, we can settle this now, man to man. I said, I don't care how big you are. If I have to take a beating, it's just a beating I'm going to have to take. But you are going to know that I was there, you know. So then, Stan Hansen was on the bus, too. So they said, no, calm down and everything. You know, it'll be okay. I said, no, I don't accept that for nobody. I said, I don't care who you are, what you are. I don't accept that talk from anybody. So then the next day, that night, we got to the hotel. And the next day, I was so irritated that night that I didn't sleep, and I got up the next day, and he came down for breakfast, and I told him, I said, come on, let's go outside. He didn't want to go outside. I said, no, let's go outside. We're going to talk this out, me and you, man to man, not around these assholes that are sitting here. And we went out, and I told him, and I said, look, and he was really big at that time, and I said, let me tell you something. I said, I don't like what you say. I said, you keep your racist jokes to yourself. You want to joke around with those other guys, that's fine. You don't do that around me. So then he said, well, you know, I'm Polish Jamaican. I said, you never hear me make any racist remarks about anybody. I said, Andre, I don't care how big you are. I said, I'll get a baseball bat, chop you down the sides, and then kick your butt, you know. And after that, for a couple of years, we really never spoke. But just before he died, I ran into him in Mexico, and we actually straightened everything out. Became friends after that.
How was work in Mexico?
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I was crazy when I first went down there because I went there in the early 80s, and it was funny the first time. We were always in tag matches. I was in a six-man tag, and I'm standing out on the apron, and my partner rolled out the ring, and I didn't know you were supposed to get in the ring without the tag, and I'm just standing there, you know. And I'm going, no, you got to get in the ring, you know. But it was really crazy. I enjoyed it there. They really treated me great there, and Mota looked out after me. And he used to tell me every night they would always have two out of three falls. He always goes, you only one bump a night. I said, that makes me happy because those rings are like falling on the floor.
Yeah. Let's go to the phone calls. We'll start with Wes in Virginia. Wes, you're first up with Bad News Alan.
Hey, Bad News, how's it going?
Not bad. How you doing?
Pretty good. I wanted to ask you, you worked Florida, didn't you, with Kevin Sullivan? And if you did, just wondering what your experiences were down there.
Yeah, I was down there with Kevin and Ray Candy, and I enjoyed it there. We didn't make no money, but I had a good time down there anyway. I like working with those guys. And I thought Sullivan was a big time, you know. Was his idea, so I thought he was crazy, because at that time he was the booker down there.
Also, yeah, real quick. Also, are you surprised that it's taken this long? I mean, people look at The Rock really not as a true African-American, I guess, but are you surprised that it's taken this long really for one to ever get over in the mainstream?
Oh, yeah. You know, like, I always felt that, like, his father, Rocky Johnson, was a hell of a wrestler, and he was, you know, they gave him a push in Florida and everything, but they never really pushed him the way he should. And there's quite a few that were around there, but, you know, it's a shame that it's the year 2000 and he's finally realized that, you know, like a guy that is a Muhammad Ali type that can make a lot of money, which Muhammad Ali made. All the boxers today are reaping the benefits from all the money and the publicity brought towards boxing.
I was going to say, but did you ever get a chance, I know you never worked for him, but did you ever get any offers or feelers or anything to work for Bill Watts during your career?
No, I haven't. No.
Okay. I was just wondering, because I know I guess early 80s, I mean, down there, they were looking for, you know, heels and everything.
Right.
And I know your name came up, but I don't know if they ever contacted you. I know you were working for Stampede at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I never worked for him.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I never even heard from him, so I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Anything else, Wes?
No, thanks for the comments, Bad News.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks so much, Wes. Let's go to Matt in San Francisco. Matt, you're next up.
Hey, Bad News. How's it going?
Not bad. How you doing?
All right. Hey, Dave, you may remember this. It was in the late 80s.
Uh-huh.
There was an independent TV station out here in the Bay Area that got the Polynesian Championship Wrestling Show.
Right.
Sure, because I remember seeing Ric Flair and Kerry Von Erich do a 60-minute draw on, I forget the station. But, yeah, and you Bad News, worked. You were working there with Lars Anderson then.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any good stories about that time?
Well, it was funny because I think somebody told me that Rock mentioned this in his book about the time they had an anniversary show for his grandfather, the Chief.
And that's right.
A lot of people don't know this, but the Chief, my beer, when I got into the business and I came to the States because he was coming back and forth to Japan, he took me under his wing more or less because I was green as grass. And he more or less treated me like his son, you know. So I had some good memories about him. And so they wanted Lars to drop the belt to me, and he didn't want to do it. And we got into the ring, and then he started trying to shoot with me and all this nonsense. You know, and so I stretched him in the ring, and then the next day we went to San Jose in California, and I was supposed to work with him again. I told him, I said, well, you got a choice tonight. You can either work with me or we can shoot. It don't make a difference to me, you know. Just said, no, tonight we'll work, you know.
Wasn't there a situation, I seem to remember something where when he was Booker and he took a beating, like was on one of those big stadium shows. I don't know if you were on that card.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that?
No, I actually wasn't, but from what I gather was that him and Leah went to some dance with all the Samoans that night, and they got into an argument. He shoved her or something, and the Samoans beat him up, you know.
Yeah, that's
right. Anyway.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
What was interesting? What some others? Look, real quick here. This is from Daniel, who says, "I was a big fan of your work in WF Stampede in Japan. Can you explain the incident? I don't know the story about this actually. It says, can you explain the incident with the WF and the naming of Sapphire? Do you have anything to do with that?"
No, I didn't actually. I went in with Vince, and I really got ticked off about it because amongst our people, African American people, that's an insult to call a woman a Sapphire because it was taken from the old Amos and Andy movies, TV show. And I actually went and told him that he shouldn't be calling her Sapphire. I said, this is a total insult to our people. And I said, why do you want to insult my people? I said, our dollar is as good as anybody else's, you know. Well, he tried to claim he didn't know enough about it, which I knew he was lying. He said, I had no idea, you know. So I said, well, since you don't know.
What a coincidence. What a coincidence.
Yeah, exactly. So then he tells me, says, I'm going to change her name. I'm going to change it. So he started calling her Sweet Sapphire. I said, this guy is too much. He just has to have his way.
Yeah. Let's go to, we got Steve in Calgary. What's up, Steve?
Hello, Bad News and Dave out there. I just wanted to ask Bad News a couple questions.
I can't hear what he's saying.
Talk louder, Steve.
Okay, I'm sorry there. Bad News, I've been a fan of yours ever since you came to Calgary. And from way back in the Stampede days. And there's a couple questions I'd like to ask you. When the Stampede shut down or got bought out by the WWF, there was a couple of years where Calgary had a void. And then when it started up again, it started up the Stampede Wrestling again, and there was something with the names not being registered or whatever. But I remember I used to sit ringside all the time, and there was a match that you were involved with. I think it was either Leo Burke or his brother, Frenchie. I'm not even sure. I can't remember his name. But you guys were right beside me in the front row, and you got pile-driven on that concrete, and I thought I heard your skull get crushed. Now, whether that was a shoot or a work or if you got really hurt, it was amazing the kind of things that go on there.
Everything we did in that match was work. Nothing was a shoot. Yeah, I remember what you're talking about. Actually, another promoter came up here, and he did some digging, and he found out that all the years that Stu had the name, he never had it registered, so he actually brought the rights to the name, and he started calling the Stampede Wrestling, and I worked, I think, a couple of shows for him, and then I went up to Japan, and by the time I got back, they closed down.
I've got a really bad connection. I can hardly hear you. And we're full phoning from Calgary, I presume. The one other question I wanted to ask you, being a fan of yours for so long, is just give me a second. I forgot here.
Can I ask, Alan, when you were wrestling, like I guess this is about 84-ish, when the territory was bought out, was there any inclination, you're just like working at a regular job with Stampede Wrestling, and then all of a sudden one day it's like Vince bought us out? Is that kind of how you got the news, or was there any?
Well, it was funny because none of the family knew. Stu called me up, though. He called my house because we would do TV every Friday. And he actually called me up, and he said, look, I sold the territory out to Vince. And he says, you're going to hear about it tonight, but I just wanted to call you and let you know before the others. So I asked him, I said, well, did Bruce and Brett and all them know? He said, no, they didn't know anything. And so apparently when I got down there, they just happened to have heard it on the news that night. And all hell broke loose. All hell broke loose. And I was just standing in the back. I was just tickled, you know, because I already knew. Stu already told me earlier that evening.
Hey, okay.
One quick question before I let you go. What I wanted to ask you was, did you ever have the opportunity to work with Archie the Stomper Goldie in Calgary here?
Oh, yeah, we were just talking about that. Yeah, he was asking about working with Archie Gouldy.
Yeah, we worked after that fiasco, and we worked a couple of times, and then not too long after that, he left, and then I went back to Japan for a while.
Terrific. All the best to you. Watch Stampede every Saturday at noon, and I'll continue to do so forever.
Okay.
Take care, friend.
All right,
bye-bye.
You know, another thing about that period. What were your thoughts? I mean, there were so many hearts.
Okay.
In Stampede, I mean, from Wayne and Ross, and I mean, there's just like a lot of kids, and they were all at one point or another wrestlers.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts of the different hearts?
Well, you know, I thought it was really funny. Like Stu, I love Stu, you know, and I love Wayne. He was the referee. But I always had problems with Brett, you know. Like, I always thought, and to this day, I still dislike the guy. I mean, I don't make no bones about it, because I feel that he wants to be something and he's really not, you know. He never treated the business the way the business should have been treated. And, you know, all Brett thinks about is himself. And, you know, he's still whining about what Vince did to him, you know. Like, I always felt, well, you know, he was there longer than anybody else. And he saw all the dirty things that Vince done to everybody, so why did he think he was any different, you know? And, you know, when we all left here, we put him over and put the belt, you know, so why couldn't he do that for somebody else? I mean, that's part of the game, you know? And I just never really got along with him that well. And actually, It's a funny story. When I came up in 82, I was working with him all around. And when I came back in 83, Stu asked me to work with him again. I refused. I said, I don't want to work with him. I said, this guy's too hard to do business with, you know. And
really?
He said, well, who you want to work with? I said, put me with Dynamite. And that's how we got together.
What about Bruce and Keith and the rest of them?
Well, Keith, he never worked that much. I think I worked one match with him all the years up here, and I worked a couple of times with him in South Africa. And Bruce, it's funny because a lot of people don't really realize this. I've never, ever worked with Bruce all the years that I was here.
Wow.
He was always in the tag in the middle, the mid-heavyweight title thing, and I was always chasing after the North American title. So I really never worked with him all those years. So. And a lot of people don't realize that. They always thought I worked with him, and I never did.
Let's go to Evan in Vancouver. Evan, you're next up with Bad News.
Hi, Bad News.
How's it going?
Good. Before I ask you your question, I just want to make a comment.
Yeah, could you speak up a little bit? I can't.
Okay, but my comment is that I think giving the title to Ric Flair was an absolute joke. I think Ric Flair obviously was a legend maybe 7 or 8 years ago, but a legend should also know when to call it quits. And everyone like praises the guy's effort, but you still have to have ability in the ring to entertain the fans, and he just lost that. And I respect him for what he's done in the past, but I just think that was a very poor move done on WWE's behalf. But for bad news, I just want to know, during your WWF tenure, don't you think your character was a bit stereotypical of the African-American person? I remember your feud with Rowdy Roddy Piper, and you used to take all these, like, mild remarks by Roddy Piper, like, really offensively. You thought they were offensive to the black person. So do you think that, like, maybe even currently, like, recently, like, in the Nation of Domination days in the WWF, do you think that black people in wrestling have been stereotyped for their characters?
Yeah, could you repeat that? Because I couldn't get everything you said.
Well, I'll repeat it so you can hear. But he basically was saying is did you think that when you were there that your character was somewhat of a stereotype, and do you think that, you know, wrestling has stereotyped? Obviously it has.
You know, it was a stereotype, and like even the part with the snake and everything, my wife really hated that, you know, because she knew
that. I hated that too, because it was such a stereotype.
Yeah, and she used to just get on my case about it, and actually it's funny because one time I had to work in San Francisco and Sacramento, and she flew in and she was going to be there with me for the 3 days, and she just lit me up for almost an hour. We're driving up to the town. By the time I got out of the car, I was like 2 feet tall, you know, and I went and gave Vince my notice. But it was everything he did was stereotyped, because they even came with me. He sent Pat Patterson to make a proposal. That they wanted me to dye my beard blonde and be almost like a Stephen Fletcher type of character, you know. And I started laughing. I said, no way, shape, or form I was going to do that. I said, you guys went too far this time, you know. And he told me, I told Vince that, and I said, oh, you told Vince, yeah. Well,
Now, when Roddy Piper, what did you think about when you did the match with Roddy Piper when he did the blackface?
Yeah. Well, it was funny because they brought me in and they asked me, I never liked Piper anyway, you know. He is a bigot, actually, and a couple of times I had to call him on his mouth and the words he likes to use. And they brought me in with Vince and him, and they said, well, we'd like to do this thing. And I said, well, yeah. I said, that sounds like a good idea to me. I'm thinking, yeah, one of the brothers is going to get a hold of him and slice his throat, you know. He deserves it. But, you know, that's the way they think, you know. They can't think that, you know, everybody should be just treated equally
on
their ability. They don't think that, you know. They always think they got to make fun of somebody, you know.
Evan, is there anything else?
Do you think colored wrestlers have overcome that barrier?
I don't like that word, but did you think that the wrestling has gotten past that point today?
I don't know. It's really hard to tell, you know, because, I mean, you take a look down into WCW, you have no African-American wrestlers down there doing anything, really, you know. You know, Vince is barely doing anything. Well, he's got The Rock now, you know. But
The Rock's never, I mean, The Rock's almost been, what's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah.
It's like The Rock is, you know, people don't even, no one thinks of The Rock as black.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
He's actually multicultural, so, you know, like, he's more or less like a Tiger Woods type of person. And you can actually say all of true African American.
Okay, guys, now it's time for WF Daily Trivia, brought to you by RC Edge. The first two people to respond correctly by email to DaveMeltzer@yada.com will win a poster of a WF Superstar, courtesy of RC Edge. And remember to include your mailing address with your answer. Here's today's question. There was a WWF championship change that took place that was completely forgotten, or almost completely forgotten, never recognized, because one of the participants in the match was not fired, as was expected. It's kind of curious. What match am I talking about? What was the title change that we're referring to that was never actually recognized, even though it took place in the ring? So anyway, that is our question, and we're going back with Bad News Alan, and... this is from Gabriel here, who wants to know, what do you think as far as things like Ultimate Fighting, that type of genre, you know, the shoot fighting that's become popular in Japan? Because UWFI was kind of like, I mean, it was a work shoot fighting, but it, right. Some of those guys like, you know, Sakuraba, who was there, is, you know, turned into a pretty much of a, you know, one of the great no holds barred fighters, I guess. And if you were younger, if you were younger and this was coming around, would it be something that would interest you, or is it just something that you wouldn't be interested in?
Yeah, I think if I was younger and still back in my judo days, and once I broke into this business, I would have loved to have gone into the Ultimate Fighting. But actually, you know, by the time it came around, I was too beat up, too old to be in there doing that with those young guys, you know.
Do you follow it at all or no?
I haven't in a while, you know. So I really don't know what's going on down there.
Okay.
I got a question real quick.
Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
Actually, first I want to apologize to Bad News. I can barely hear you, so you might have already answered this question. But I know you did a lot of work for ICW up in Canada until like about a year ago, and I was wondering if there was, you know, you ever thought about doing occasional matches or anything like that, or the knees just too bad?
He's asking me, I caught some of it, if I'm going to...
Okay, what he was asking you about is there any chance that you would actually wrestle again now, or... Oh, he said no.
No, my wrestling days are over with. Since they put in these artificial knees, that's it.
Was it hard for you to walk away from being an active competitor after 22 years and being an athlete for basically your whole life?
No, not really, because it was hard for me to walk away from judo after the Olympics because I trained for so long and, you know, like I said, it left a bitter taste in my mouth with all the politics that went on. But this business here was more or less the same thing, but it was easy for me to walk away from because it was show business. It wasn't something that I really had to go out there and do on my own. You know, it was all show business, so it was easy for me to leave.
Now, so you finished judo, what is it, after the 76 Olympics? Is that right?
What's that?
Okay, when you were the 76 Olympics, was that, did you do any judo after the 76 Olympics?
No, that was it. That was my last tournament.
Okay, and you got the bronze medal. You got the bronze medal there.
Yes.
Was there any thought, like when that thing was over, you got the bronze, that you were going to stick around for four more years, or was it just like, this is it, I've had it with judo?
Well, yeah, I knew before I went there because, like I said, they actually, the USJF, the organization that ran judo in the United States, actually tried to keep me from going to the Olympics. They didn't even want me. I was the defending national champ. And they actually didn't even want me to go to the trials because another organization came along called the USJA, and I belonged to that, and it was all a bunch of young guys who were trying to, more or less a nationalistic group that wanted to have more Americans push towards winning medals, you know? So there was so much fighting going on there, and there was so much politics going on. That, like I said, they actually tried to stop me from going to the Olympics. And at the last moment, they changed their mind. I went to the trials, I won the trials, and I went to the Olympics and won a gold medal. Not a gold, a bronze, excuse me. But I knew, even before the tournament started, that was going to be my last tournament.
Okay.
Yes.
And this is a question from Chris, who says who was asking... you kind of touched on this earlier. What were the details of your, you know, basically, where did you make the decision when you were leaving the WWF, or how did that come about?
Well, you know, what it came down to was I was just so sick of the nonsense that went on. They never kept their word to me. They made all kind of promises to me. And then when I found out, when I did that WrestleMania 6, I found out that they actually paid Piper five times more than they paid me. I really, really got tipped off about that. You know, I thought it was totally unfair. I figured that this is show business. If anything, they should have split the money down the middle, and he got half of what he got, and I would have got half. But they figured that he he was in there click with them, they would pay me slave wages and give him all the money, and I really disliked it. So I told him I was leaving. I gave him my notice that at that SummerSlam, which was the 29th of August, I think it was, I gave my notice. I said, this was going to be my last match. I'm out of here. I was going back to Japan. So Vince begged me to stay until November. He said, please, please, I got all these, because they put me with Jake. And the thing went over so big, every time that we went in, the people really got into it, that they actually begged me to stay for two more trips around the territory. Once we were going to, I came in that afternoon, and I did close to 100 interviews that we were going to do street fights all around, and then we were going to do cage matches all around the territory. But, so I said, okay, so I came in and I did the interviews, and then that night, they told me they wanted me, and I put Jake all over every town that we were in, I put him over. But they wanted me to put him over that night on TV and on the pay-per-view. And I said, this don't make any sense. If I got to go two more times around the territory with him, why would the people come out business-wise to see him? He already beat me. They're not going to come pay to see that. I said, don't make any sense. Why don't we save this to the end? And they, you know, like I said, Vince always has to have his way. And he just didn't see it that way. And so that was my last day there.
How did, what happened with New Japan? Was it just one of those things that did, you know, what led to you going, you know, what organizations did you go to? Because I know there was UWFI. Was there any other organizations you worked for in Japan?
Well, I actually went to UWFI. What the problem was that, Sakaguchi, who was the vice president at the time, when I came, started in New Japan for wrestling, him and I never got along. We just, there was something, I don't know what it was, but we just always had a problem. And Inuki stood between the two of us, and being that Inuki was the president and everything, he really liked me and he always took care of me. Well, after he went into politics and I went to work for the WWF, when I came back, he was in charge, and what he started doing was cutting my tours, because I was guaranteed four or five tours a year, and he started cutting me down to, well, he cut me down to three, and then to two, and then it got down to one. So Takata, who used to be a member of the UWF, he was actually one of our juniors at the time, years ago, when he started his own group, UWF International, he asked me, could I come over there and do a show with Gary? They wanted me to work with him. And I said, sure. So the office didn't like it. And I said, well, you know, it's unfair. I said, you got Steve Williams working for Baba and working for you, so why can't I go over there and just do this one show? And they couldn't see it that way, so I just left.
This is a question right here. Actually, this is when you mentioned Chavo Guerrero.
Yeah.
I think that the caller, I just want to make clear that the caller was going like, how old is Chavo? Because his son is actually wrestling in WCW. I guess he was going like, whoa, wait a minute. And it's actually the Chavo that Bad News was referring to was Chavo Guerrero Jr.'s father, who wrestled in Japan, Los Angeles. Did you ever wrestle with Chavo in Los Angeles, or was that a different time period?
Oh, yeah. many a times. Actually, my last three matches were with him. In Los Angeles before I left there. I was getting ready to go back to Japan, and we had a wrestling match, and then I challenged him to a judo match, and then I challenged him to a cage match in the street town. But, I wrestled him many times.
What were your thoughts as far as working in the Los Angeles territory when you worked? Because it was kind of its, I don't remember if it was his dying days, but certainly the territory had seen much better days.
Yeah, it was definitely on his last leg. But I enjoyed it because I have a sister who's a year younger than me. She's been out there for about 30 years, so I lived with her, and I was with my nephews and all that. So, like, we didn't make no money, but we were home every night, so I enjoyed it. It gave me a break away from Japan at the time, because I was on every tour there, more or less, on Japan, and after a while it got a bit much, you know. So I was there, and we were home every night, so I enjoyed it, you know, just being out there with my family and everything.
Let's go to Randy in Tennessee. Randy, you're up with Bad News Allen.
What's up? Hey, how's everybody doing?
We're doing really good.
I can't hear him that good.
Okay, talk really loud, Randy.
Bad News, what do you think of today's wrestling, WWF, WCW, and ECW?
Well, you know, I think when I first started in this business, most of the guys weren't in any kind of shape at all. I mean, if you looked at them, you said, you know, these guys can't be no athletes. I mean, look at them, you know. They're all fat and out of shape and everything. But today's wrestlers, the guys are in the gym and they're working hard and everything because they want their bodies to look beautiful. But what is missing, though, psychology that the old guys had. You had a certain psychology there that they can actually just look at the audience sometime and the people would get hot, you know. But now these guys, they want to do all this crazy stuff. They're doing 101 high spots. This should be a finish. And they're using that. And so many of them are getting injured by doing stuff that they shouldn't be doing, you know. And, like, I like the idea that they go to the gym and train and everything, but I think that also they should have somebody there teaching these guys the psychology of what this business is about, because somehow it's gotten lost.
Anything else, Randy?
And also, what was your favorite match in the WWF?
My favorite match in the WWF? It had to be working with Jake, because I enjoyed working with him. I worked with him probably more than anybody else there. You know, like, they had me 9 matches with Hogan, and I think they had me with the times with Macho Man. But working with Jake, I enjoyed working with him. He was really, he had good psychology, and he was a good worker. It was just too bad he had bad habits.
And Dave, about last night's show, wouldn't you say that the segment with Flair and Arn Anderson last night kind of saved the show from being real bad show?
Yeah, absolutely. Arn Anderson's interview was phenomenal.
Uh-huh. Well, I didn't see last night's show, so...
Yeah.
What'd you think of the first match, Flip the Animals versus the...
I was doing a Yahoo chat, so I actually I had it on, but I didn't hear it, if you know what I mean. So it's probably not a good thing for me to judge. I was going to watch it back on tape, and I just had not had a chance to do that, so... I mean, I could see just from what I saw, I thought the Filthy Animals ring entrance was tremendous, but then what I was watching, it appeared they were just getting bounced around, so I was thinking, like, you know, you're going to make this great ring entrance, at least give the guy some credibility once the bell rings, and they didn't seem to do that, but maybe that's an unfair thing for me to say right now.
The opener?
Yeah, the Filthy Animals, yeah, that match, yeah.
Yeah, it was like they took the idea from Monday that they had with, you know, getting the woman down there to do CPR and everything like that, and it was funny the first time, and it wasn't the second time.
Well, they're going to do it. They're going to do it every TV show forever.
Yeah.
That's certainly my opinion. You know, the woman giving the CPR.
And also, how many more times are we going to see an ambulance match?
At least once more in the pay-per-view. Probably, that's like the new, probably regularly now. I think the bad part about it was that, wasn't the finish actually of the match that Mike Awesome ran into the ambulance to escape from Scott Steiner?
Right.
Wasn't that the technical finish?
Yeah.
Right.
So it's kind of like they've already defeated the purpose of it, and they've only done, like, 2 or 3 of them, you know?
It's going to end up like the cage match where every single week is.
We're going to have gimmick matches up and down the TV show, and not one of them is going to draw a dime, and we're pretty much at that level right now. I mean, that's something, you know, talk about with Alan is, you know, you would build up, whether it was WWF or Stampede, you would build up to a gimmick match that made sense,
right.
And if it was done right, theoretically it would up the house, and now... You know, we have these gimmick matches that are just thrown out there because they just have no, they can't, they feel they can't put people in wrestling matches, and the gimmick means nothing anyway, so what's the point?
Well, you know, that's the unfortunate thing, especially with the WWF. I think they're more guilty than anybody else. Before, you used to can just bring in anybody and just put them in there and let them work and let them show their talent, what they had, you know, what they could produce. But now, he's gotten so that everybody has to have a gimmick, and he's got people in there he don't know what to do with, you know. And every match, like you said, is a gimmick match now. Before, you used to build up to it. Like, it would take months at a time. You'd tell a story, and you'd work up to it, you know. But now they just throw it in there for no reason at all, you know.
Well, in the old days, the gimmick would make sense, and two, the gimmick would settle something. And now, I mean, I think that they're afraid to ever actually put anyone over. You know, it's like they're afraid to put anyone over or have someone put someone really over. I mean, they may
right.
do pinfalls, but
right.
it's like, you know, it's like it's a pinfall, and then the other guy jumps up and starts beating him up. And so
yeah.
there's no real winner and loser, and I think that it, you know, it just muffles everything.
Well, you know, like
I said,
when
no one knows what the stipulations
are. Like, if you have a run-in, that was, like, way down the road. You tell a story, but every match now you watch is a run-in or some interference, or they throw a gimmick match together that means nothing, and they, like you said, they're afraid to actually have somebody just go over and win without... 50 people coming out there and beating the hell out of the guy after he won the match or whatever, you know.
Don't you think, and especially now, even like in the 70s and the 80s, I think people took the wins and the losses as far as fans
yeah.
a lot more seriously, and certainly the business tried to portray it as real competition, so who won and lost was important.
Right.
Yeah. Now,
well, now today, the belt means nothing. I mean, it's traded back and forth every other week. I mean, he even got the promoter now. He was champ at one time and all this kind of nonsense, you know. So it really means nothing no more, you know.
But I mean, the thing is today, where legitimately the wins and losses don't mean anything, they are above board and telling everyone this is all scripted, this
right.
is all, you know, that. And yet, they're actually more afraid to put somebody over now
right.
than they were back when it actually probably meant something as far as your perception and your position.
Yeah, exactly. That's true there. I agree with you there. 100%, you know. Makes no sense at all, you know.
Okay, we've got to...
There's somewhere along the line, the psychology of this business has gotten totally lost.
Okay, William Sanders from North Carolina and Scott Look from Maine were winners in our WWF trivia contest, the match that we were referring to. This was a WWF championship. It was actually a tag team title match where the Rockers, this was in 1990, defeated the Hart Foundation. And the reason that that match took place in Fort Wayne, Indiana, was because the plans were to fire Jim Neidhart. And then about a couple of days later, I don't know what decisions were made in the WF booking, but they decided to keep Jim Neidhart and just ignore that the title ever changed hands. They actually did a promo locally to explain to the local fans who had been to the show, saying that the ring ropes were not tightened at the right tension, so therefore the match was ruled.
Did it break?
I think the ring ropes broke or something, yeah. So they ruled that as the reason that it wasn't... They had Jack Tunney make an announcement for the fans in Fort Wayne who had seen it, and it was just ignored in the rest of the country. So anyway, that was the story on that one. And also, WCW, this is an email from Eric, who says, WCW is promoting a major announcement from Terry Funk Monday on Nitro, saying that Terry's wife and Dory Funk will be at the show. So I guess they're trying to imply that Terry Funk is retiring. How many people can we have retire? Like, every week on wrestling, we have to have three people retire.
That's right.
And when someone finally does, no one's ever going to believe it.
Yeah, really.
It's, like, unbelievable. Especially Terry Funk, of all people. I mean, were you ever in the same territory as Terry Funk?
No, I wasn't. Actually, when I used to... work Japan. He was with New Japan for He was with All Japan Pro Wrestling, and I was with New Japan Pro Wrestling. So I never really worked the same territories with him. But he's quite a character, though.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's true, like you said, you know, everybody retires every other week. Well, this is like I'm having a hard time convincing people that I'm actually retired. They don't want to believe it, you know.
But they still call you up and go, "Oh, please, just work our show next week."
I got people calling me up and everything. Well, we got some guy calling me from Connecticut. We running some shows up here. Like I said, look, I told you I'm retired. I'm not wrestling anymore, you know.
Did you? I guess you probably never would have met him. Maybe you have. I don't know. Did you ever run into Jumbo Tsuruta?
Jumbo, no, I never did meet him. No, not at all.
You know, I don't know if you heard, but he passed away a couple of days ago.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, a Saturday, actually.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow, he's a young guy. I mean, he's a lot younger than I was.
Yeah, 49. He was, he was having a kidney transplant, and I guess he bled to death in surgery.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really sad.
Yeah, it is. No, I never met him. But
yeah.
It used to be, you know, like, there was always a heat between Bobber and Inuki's group, you know, always Inuki's group would claim, you know, our wrestling was hotter looking than theirs, and there was more too American, you know, that's how they used to put it all the time, you know. That's a shame. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. We've got, let's go to David in Cincinnati. David, you're on the line with Bad News.
Hey, how you doing, Dave?
I'm doing good.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you something. I don't like to bring Bob Ryder's name up very much, but,
You can. It's okay.
You said in your Observer, you talked about the buy rate for Slamborees being so low.
Very low.
That, like, WCW wouldn't even acknowledge it?
They would not give a number. I was told by someone in the company it was well below 0.2, but they couldn't tell me how low much below 0.2 is because they didn't want it out. So it's below 0.2. Well, we'll get the exact number. We'll get a good number within a week or two. It always comes out. But, yeah, I know he's, like, trying to spin it that it wasn't a bad buy rate. I mean, it was... What can you say? Below 0.2? I mean, the number speaks for...
Wait, he said on his... I don't listen to WCW Live, so I'm not going to... I don't know the exact words, but on the recap of OneWrestling.com, he criticized you for printing that, and he said that WCW never releases buy rate information.
I know, and he's released buy rates of WCW on almost every show up until this one, right? Isn't that hilarious?
Even there must be some conspiracy, because I remember he released, wasn't there a buy rate that did a .11? I think it was uncensored.
It was a .13, which he said was a .12, which probably, you know, it's not saying one of them was right or wrong, because it's not an exact science.
Well, I was wondering, why would Bob Ryder...
Why did he release a .13? Why did he release a .13 when he works for the company? I don't know. Think about that. Think about why he did that. When this one, he won't release it. Think about that. I think the answer is obvious, if you think about it.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, I mean, why? Yeah, but why would he? Obviously, he like didn't want Kevin Sullivan in charge. Since, I mean, I don't understand like why he would actually acknowledge a .13 in his so-called independent notes from Bob column online.
I think that you just answered your question.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I got a question for Bad News.
Bad News, can you hear him?
Not too well.
Can you hear this?
Just tell me and I'll ask him, because he can hear me.
Can you hear that TV? Bad News. It's an interview with Bad News.
From when?
Saturday night's main event, right before match with Hogan, which I remember Bad News actually carried Hogan to a pretty good match.
Oh, he said you carried Hogan to a good match. On Saturday night's main event.
And if I'm not, I don't know, I kind of remember seeing some good matches between Bad News and Savage.
I remember Bad News and Savage. Was it Bad News and Savage in Chicago? I remember it was really weird because Savage had just gone heel on television with a feud with Hogan, but he was still booked with Bad News at the house shows. It was very strange watching Savage work a match as a babyface against you and then turn heel after the match was over because he was supposed to be a heel. I saw that in Chicago once.
I thought that was probably one of the dumbest. They've done more dumb things since then. But I thought at that time that was pretty stupid, you know, because he was working with me. And even I remember one time we were in San Francisco, and, you know, that's when they was trying to turn him a heel to work against Hogan. And the people just booed the heck out of me, and everything he did, they would just boo me and cheer him, you know.
Speaking of OneWrestling.com, Dave Shear once commented, he said, like, the worst gimmick he ever saw was when you brought a rat to the ringside.
Yeah.
Whose idea was that?
That's Dan.
Vince?
Every idea that you see them do on TV is their idea, you know. Everyone.
He said it was Vince's idea.
Yeah, that's Vince's idea.
That was pretty bad. Actually, what was real interesting is I remember like a little bit later they had like Jake Roberts' Snake Damian killed, and then they like immediately dropped the angle, and then before you knew it, Earthquake, the guy who killed his snake, was teaming up with him with Jake for a Survivor Series match.
Yeah. Well, they do stuff like that quicker these days, though, than they did then.
But the thing with Macho Man, if I can remember correctly, I don't think that Macho Man. Yeah, I don't think he like became a full fledged heel until after that WrestleMania 5 match. I think it was just like.
They wanted him. He was a total heel off of the Saturday night's main event.
A lot of times, how often did they tape those Saturday night's main events in advance?
In those days, it could have been anywhere from like a day or two to about a week or two.
I remember whenever I went to those like WWF TV tapings in like the late 80s or early 90s, God, I'd sit through like 6 hours of just squash matches.
And I went to many of those.
You know what's funny? The first time they came up here to do TV, they did one in Edmonton, and all my in-laws live up there, and they had no idea that it was going to be, the squash matches and what TV was like. And I got them tickets and everything, and they went. And my youngest nephew really liked Hogan, because a couple of times Hogan would take pictures with him and everything. And he never did see Hogan work that night, because he would go on last. Sometime it was 12:31 in the morning, you know. I remember working with him in the dark match. It was the main event in Huntsville, Alabama. And we went in the ring at 1:15 in the morning.
Oh, that's brutal.
And, like, they had maybe five people in the audience left. The people who cared, we killed each other, you know.
Oh, man. I remember going to see a lot of those shows, you know, well after midnight, and then Hogan would come on. And then sometimes Hogan would go out and do, like, I saw him do, like, 2- and 3-minute matches sometimes,
exactly.
You know, after people waited all that time. And it was so late, I can almost see why, but it was like.
Well, I went in the Huntsville. We went out, like, 3 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
Just people were so fed up with seeing, you know, they've seen 100 matches before they saw that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else, Dave?
No, I was just going to say, like, it got old watching all those Papa Shango matches.
Well, it didn't matter who it was. By the, I just remember going to the Wrestling Challenge tapings where they would tape like four TV shows in one night.
Yeah.
By the fourth time you've seen the same guys, you know, squash guys in 3 minutes, it didn't matter who it was.
One of those house shows that I went to, it was really awesome. They had a Bret Hart Shawn Michaels match and a Macho Man Ric Flair match in one show.
Yeah. I mean, I remember. You know, I saw some good shows too.
I also wanted to comment. You said that like the sellout streak ended in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I went to that house show, there was still like a ton of people there, even though it wasn't like totally sold out. And I remember the last few times I went there, it did sell out. And the last WCW show there was a sellout. It was that pay-per-view where Chris Benoit. I'm not sure if I should say won the title because the match never happened.
That show you could say was a sellout, but when half the tickets are freebies, you know what I mean? I don't consider that a sellout. You know, when the WCW did the pay-per-view in January, I mean, they gave away so many tickets to that show, but it was packed. I know it was packed.
There is a Nitro coming July 31st. How do I get free tickets? Because I hear about how they pay for the audiences.
I don't know how they do it. I mean, I think usually just, like in a lot of places, just go to the college, you know? That's where they give them away. It's a lot of college kids.
If I
you know,
start walking around there, there are going to be guys like handing me tickets.
I don't know about that, but it's, you know, maybe by then it'll be hard enough to
deals were, like with what Wade Keller reported, they had like the 13th caller would get free Nitro tickets, and there never was a 13th caller.
It was a Thunder in Pennsylvania. They said the 13th caller would get tickets when they did the Thunder in Philadelphia, yeah, and they never had 13 callers, yeah. That was sad. That was when it was worse than it is even now.
What, with the Sullivan regime?
Yeah, the Sullivan regime. I mean, you know, no matter what anyone would say, it's better now. It's not. The logic's probably no better, but at least there's
one
of the
advantages, though, of now is the Sullivan regime. They never had, like, Kevin Nash, or they never had, like, the big names that Vince Russo hot-shotted back.
Yeah, all the guys that are still injured that they have working matches, yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
All right, Dave, I guess I better get going. So, okay. It was nice talking to you. I guess we'll see you at the Pillman show.
Yep, I'll be there.
All right.
Okay, let's go to Masad in Pennsylvania. You're going to be our last caller.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, how are you?
Bad news. How are you guys?
Not bad.
Yeah, Dave, I wanted to ask you about D'Lo's situation right now. Are they just keeping him off matches because they think he's sloppy or what?
I don't know what the situation is with him. You know, there's... I can't give you a good answer there. You know, I mean, they have so many guys, and there's a couple guys like Val Venus and D'Lo Brown, for whatever reason, are just kind of like they haven't really had a role. And then on the show that actually airs tonight, you know, they're going to put Val Venus in a role where he's, you know, going to challenge the Benoit Jericho winner. You know, they did a little program with D'Lo and The Godfather, but, you know, it didn't really go anywhere. I mean, they weren't hot as a team, and then they split them up, and it's not a good program. You know, he came out with the pimp outfit, and, yeah, I don't know. It wasn't the right thing for him anyway.
If you were going to give a program... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
If you were going to give a program to either Val Venus or D'Lo, who would you pick?
Oh, man, I don't know. I kind of consider them about the same level right now. D'Lo might be a little better worker, but Val Venus is more charismatic as a talker. At least he can't, you know, so I don't know. I mean, they just have to come up with storylines, and right now they just haven't been thinking about those guys. I don't know if there's a specific reason. I mean, some people think it's because, you know, D'Lo may have entertained offers to go to WCW, and they've kind of iced him for a little while. I mean, that could be. I don't know if that's true.
Can you recommend an All Japan match? Best one so far.
Misawa Kobashi, the one that won Match of the Year in 98, was like one of the great matches of all time. But I mean,
how much that was in?
Oh God, I forget off the top of my head. But any Misawa Kobashi match, I think will, you know, is they're all tremendous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the best feud in wrestling in the ring.
You remember WrestleWar, Flair Steamboat? Were you at that show?
The one in Nashville?
Yeah, the one that was the Match of the Year.
Yeah, I was at that one.
Yeah,
I was at that one.
Yeah, I thought I saw you on the tape.
Oh wow, that's scary. I'm thinking up ribbing about my haircut.
There.
What?
Kinda.
Okay, Brian's got something to say.
Oh yeah, Brian.
I'm just wondering why you would ask me was there if he was on the tape.
Because I was asking because I was reading the Netco print, and he was like, well, there's Dave Meltzer with an afro. And I just started laughing.
That's probably right. never have photos of you put in a magazine 10 years after they were taken. Oh, my God.
I'm going to leave now. Just before I leave, I just want to ask you another question. Do you think RVD would ever go to Big Two or not, Van Damme?
Someday he will, you know, when his contract's up or something. Or, you know, you got to think he's a young guy sooner or later.
I sure hope he goes to WWF because I just can't stand WCW and I really want to watch him. All right. I'm sorry.
Okay.
All right, Dave.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, we are pretty much out of time right now. Bad News, I want to thank you very much for doing the show tonight. This was a lot of fun. What stuff, besides the announcing for Stampede, did you do guest appearances or things like that on any of the shows, or what's going on like in the Canadian and, you know, that area, Western Canada?
Well, there's not much going on now, but Tim Flowers runs a lot of stuff out in Vancouver, and sometime in September should be going out there to help him out again.
And also, is there anyone that's working in Stampede that like you think that like people should kind of keep their eye out for, some of the guys you think really have a lot of promise?
Yeah, well, I think that Pistol Pilot has a lot of promise. He reminds me of the young Dynamite. And you got Tiger Khan, who I think is a good worker. You got the Johnny Devine, who's a heck of a worker and a really good talker. He's I don't know if anybody wants to give him a chance because he's really small, you know. But, I mean, you could do anything with anybody in this day and age. And, you got quite a few guys that got potential, you know.
When we're running, like, totally low on time, you were actually there during that period where Dynamite and Satoru Sayama pretty much put the smaller guys on the map. I mean, what were your thoughts, like, being in Japan when that stuff was going on as far as the lighter weight guys?
Well, I thought, like I said, there's some matches that I would pay to see, and there's some matches that you couldn't pay me to go see. But when you have Sayama, Tiger Mask, and Dynamite, I would pay to go see them, and Chris Benoit and Liger. I mean, these guys used to have tremendous matches. I remember an incident where they brought Dynamite and Tiger Mask to New York, to Madison Square Garden, and Vince Sr. was still alive. He was still running everything. And Bob Backlund was champ at the time, and they put those two guys on second, and they tore the house down. I mean, the people usually people from New York, they're pretty hardcore, and they're skeptical of everything. But they actually gave them a standing ovation, and Vince Sr. almost had a heart attack. He's going, well, what am I champ? How is he going to follow those guys? You know, and he said, well, nobody can follow them, so, you know, no need to cry about it, enjoy what they did, you know. But he always had this thing, if you weren't 6 feet and over, he didn't want to use it. So, but I was glad, even though, like, I don't like a lot of things that Vince Jr.'s done, at least one thing he's done is gave everybody a chance, no matter what size you were.
Yeah, I think a lot of that was a Sayama, and then later Rey Mysterio really opened that up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I like what they've done because, you know, they brought excitement to the ring. Because there's certain guys, I'm not ashamed to say, you know, like Hogan, he's always had charisma, but he was never a good worker. And now he's embarrassing. I think he should have retired 5 years ago already, you know. And give the young guys a chance to get rid of those old guys, you know, get them out of there now. They had their chance. They got to go.
Okay. Bad News, I want to thank you very much for doing the show. And tomorrow, don't forget.